Welcome to Talking Supply Chain. In each episode, you'll hear from the authors that make Supply Chain Management Review such a special publication. This podcast is hosted by Bob Troublecock, Editorial Director of Supply Chain Management Review. Remember that Bob welcomes your comments now to today's episode. Welcome to today's episode of Talking Supply Chain, the New Oil. I'm Bob Troublecock, and joining me today is Lewis Black. Lewis is the CEO of Almonte Industries. Almonte is a turnaround firm that specializes in acquiring distressed and underperforming operations and assets in tungsten markets. Lewis, welcome.
Hey, Bob. How you going?
We're doing well, and thanks for joining us. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
No problem.
EVs or electric vehicles are in the news today, and I'm not just talking about Tesla. It seems as if every global automaker worth their salt has committed to phasing out internal combustion engines by around 2035. What's more, we're now seeing action in EVs for the industrial truck market. GE Appliances, for instance, is purchasing a fleet of electric trucks for short hauls from the port to a logistics center or between logistics support centers and manufacturing plants. In fact, a few years ago, I leased a Nissan Leaf, that's always a little hard to say, an all-electric vehicle, so I could learn firsthand what it's like to drive an EV as my primary vehicle. And I have to tell you, there were limitations, but I had a fun 3 years driving an EV. So I've been following these developments with interest. It's all moving so fast, and maybe too fast, based on the conversation I had with Lewis on this topic last fall. Back then, we were talking about whether batteries we need for all those electric vehicles might create the next big oil war or its equivalent. That's what we're going to talk about today. Lewis, to get us started, tell us first just a little bit about your company. More importantly, about tungsten, the metal that your firm specializes in. I'm guessing that most of my listeners have heard of tungsten, but really don't know a lot about it.
Well, we're the largest producers of tungsten outside of China. China is the dominant producer of tungsten. And tungsten is both an industrial metal and a technology metal. So it's used in the traditional industries, aerospace, automotive, defense, medical. But it's also now used across the board through EV batteries, semiconductors, 5G networks. So it's sort of got a foot in both camps. And that gives us obviously a very unique insight from our customers who are all vertical. So our customers go all the way through to the end product, and they are the ones who supply to the Boeings, the GMs, the Fords. So we do have a good indication as to what's going on. But as I said, China is the dominant player in our sector.
And I know that's going to come up here in a minute. So when we spoke last fall, before we got to China and tungsten and EV batteries and all of that, you really gave me a great rundown on the development of the EV market from, starting with Prius hybrids to Tesla or GM or whomever is doing EVs today, and also about where now politics and manufacturing seem to be aligning. Can you walk us through that, how you're seeing it as a tungsten producer?
Well, firstly, I on a side note, Bob, I'd just like to point out that when you had your Leaf, you were a pioneer. And you're a brave man, because if we're perfectly honest, it wasn't the greatest car in the world. I think electric vehicles have come leaps and bounds, but there are some fundamental problems that I see from a tungsten perspective. Right now, I think California has the biggest takeoff of EVs. It's about 6% of sales are EVs. You've seen an explosion of commodity prices on the back of this huge push towards more a green future. That is ultimately a demand supply dynamic. And ultimately, there is by no means anywhere close to enough raw materials to be able to increase EVs to replace gasoline, diesel vehicles in the schedule that it's being talked about. And I think that one of the problems it has been exacerbated is politically, it is a wonderful example of a great soundbite. We're going to go EVs, we're going to save the planet. It's rather similar to the one they said about tungsten light bulbs, incandescent light bulbs. Get rid of those, we'll save the planet. 20 years ago, they were saying these in Europe, diesel vehicles, gasoline cars are the devil incarnate. You must go diesel. And so it feels in many ways it's got that sort of momentum. But the difference is this time is that there literally is not enough raw materials to in fact produce anywhere near the numbers that are being talked about. It just does not exist. And so I think that's your problem number one. Second problem is, of course, is the infrastructure to drive these vehicles. I mean, I know that introducing a large proportion of EVs into a city environment is going to help with noise pollution, with air quality. I think that's a very noble undertaking, and we have to do it. But most of your power is still generated by fossil fuels. So you sort of, you know, borrow from Peter to pay Paul. It's a sort of an unusual situation, as well as the fact that in North America, the infrastructure alone is never going to be able to cope with these additional demands. I mean, you see in California, you see in Texas, whenever there is any kind of heat wave, blackouts, you know, commence from those demands. So I think more thought has to go into this program. And I think politicians are caught between a rock and a hard place. Politicians' ambition is to be elected and re-elected and for that cycle to continue, which means everything you do has to be contained within that election cycle. And to, in fact, make a plan that is going out, as you said, to 2035, and you obviously have to develop the raw material supply chains to be able to produce those vehicles, to actually produce them, to sell them, to power them, is a program that's going to very much go past an election cycle. And so the question is, what happens then?
Yeah, you know, you brought up something really interesting. So I never thought of myself as a pioneer. However, when I leased my car, it was back when even Tesla was getting like 120 miles on a charge. The Leaf at the time, you know, said it got 100 miles, but it was really like 85. And I could induce range anxiety to friends if we were going to a restaurant that was uphill. I live in New Hampshire, so lots of hills. But the big thing that I learned was even if you know, I think now the range for a Tesla or like the Chevy Bolt is around, say, 350 miles, give or take, which sounds great. You can go 350 miles, but it still takes a couple of hours on a fast charger to recharge your car versus, you know, 10 minutes at the gas pump. So if you're, you know, if you're doing a 700-mile trip and you're going to try and do it in a day, you've just added, you know, 4 to 6 hours to your trip, which seems like an issue, even if you have the infrastructure. You know, there aren't, where I live, there aren't very many chargers getting off the highway. You have to go into towns and find them. But that charging infrastructure isn't there. But even if it is there, you know, you wonder if as a primary vehicle versus, you know, your secondary car for around town or something, if, yeah, how practical it's going to be to try and make that switch over.
Well, I think that the focus of the industry before Tesla really came along and made EVs very fashionable and very desirable.
Yeah.
Were hybrids. So a hybrid was a sort of compromise. It was a sort of one foot in each camp. And on that basis, you were doing your bit, but you weren't sacrificing many of the things you've come to enjoy, which was range. And I think all the car manufacturers were very much, that was their focus. And the quality of the hybrids, you know, I mean, they were very technically very advanced, but you know, the Prius was not exactly a hugely desirable car. It was a statement car in saying that I'm trying to do something to help the environment. But as a car itself, I mean, you know, it, with no disrespect to Prius, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a Tesla.
Right.
And that ultimately is what Tesla has done, is that they've shifted the whole focus of car manufacturers who are, you know, perhaps a little slow moving, very conservative in their approach. Very methodical, and the new boy has come on the block and has just shaken everything up. And so now everyone is in a mad panic to compete. And I have no doubt in time they will be able to compete, because once these juggernauts start to roll, they will do so. And I think on the basis of the amount of investment that's going in, the range issue and the charging issue will become less and less of an issue going forward. I mean, the new batteries coming out of South Korea, I saw Mercedes announced they have an EV now that will do 1,000 kilometers, or 600 miles.
Wow.
So I think that problem will be addressed. I think the two issues that you have, as I've already mentioned, are raw materials, but also cost. Right now, the Leaf was exceptional because it was more of a cost-effective approach to an EV. But generally, EVs that are available right now and in the next sort of 12 to 18 months are luxury items. They are not cheap. And this is a combination of increasing raw material costs, scarcity of those raw materials, and that right now, they are seen as I said, a luxury item. So I think if you're really going to embrace the EV revolution as a government and as an industry, you have to bring cars down so they can compete directly with gasoline vehicles. You can get the same range. You're only at the gas station, the charge station for 10 minutes. And the car is costing you, you know, instead of $50,000, it's costing you $15,000, as an example. So I think those are really, once EVs reach that point, and that would mean a very much more efficient supply chain in the sense that there is much more availability of raw materials. I think EVs are still going to be a much loved, desirable luxury item.
So walk me two things, since tungsten is, you know, essential to all of this. Explain to us first how tungsten's used, and then second, can you walk us through sort of the nature of availability of tungsten, where it's mined, how it's processed, and what the bottlenecks are around just tungsten?
Well, if we just talk about EVs, so tungsten is used as a tungsten gas to in a semiconductor. So you want to produce a semiconductor, you pump each semiconductor with this tungsten gas that lines it with a nano fraction size coating of tungsten. And that's in every semiconductor. And semiconductor, I think we're all very aware, there are significant shortages, which has caused enormous bottlenecks at every car manufacturer on the planet. And it's right. In turn has driven the cost of secondhand vehicles through the roof. If I'd known that, I would not have sold my old car 2 years ago, but who knew? And I think that if you look in a normal gasoline vehicle, you use somewhere in the region of 800 semiconductors. In an EV, you use over 2,000. So the EV push is even exacerbating the shortages of semiconductors. And in terms of batteries, the new generation of batteries they're producing in South Korea are using tungsten in both the anodes and the cathodes. So the idea is it reduces the amount of cobalt, which allows you to put more nickel in the battery, which allows greater charge, faster charge time, and holding a longer charge. So getting closer and closer to the performance of a gasoline vehicle. In terms of tungsten, where it's found, well, it's a declining resource because in the 50s and 60s, it was more valuable than gold. So all the mines in North America, South America, it was like a huge gold rush. And it was actually the price was so great because it was at a time when the world thought it was a really sensible strategy after World War II to continue having wars, whether it be the Korean War, Vietnam War, the militarization of the Soviet Union. It was a huge, enormous consumer of tungsten for defense. Then, of course, in the 80s, China arrived into the market with a lot of tungsten. They were mining locally at a very knockdown price, and it wiped out every mine except for two in the West. One was in Austria, one is in Portugal. We own the Portuguese mine, which has been running for about 126 years. You find smaller artisanal mines, which are basically, you know, three guys in a bucket in places in Africa, some in Mongolia, that only operates in spring and the fall. Spring and in the fall in Mongolia, no water in the summer, too frozen in the winter. All the mines in South Africa, South America are pretty much depleted. There's China has a declining resources, so we don't have a limitless supply. And the rest of tungsten you find in low-grade projects that were researched under the Soviet Union in all the wonderful hotspots of the Caucasus, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, that are literally in the middle of nowhere. So I think that the future, if you're in the tungsten business, is great. The prices are going to continue to strengthen and continue to go up because the demand is increasing, you know, every month. But in terms of satisfying that demand, it's going to be very difficult, and it's an unsubstitutable product. So there's nothing you can substitute it with. And so I think at some point, you know, governments are going to have to get far more involved in looking at how to approach, not just tungsten. There's a whole series of rare earths that ultimately there has to be a sensible global approach to this problem.
When you started talking about the location in China and Russia, I started thinking, if you just tell us that the really big deposits are also in North Korea and Iran, we would have, you know, gone all around all the bases.
There is actually deposits in North Korea. In fact, one of the ways that North Korea finances itself is by mining tungsten and then selling it into China. Iran, though, they don't have any tungsten, not that we know of. But yes, you're absolutely right. Strangely enough, because of tungsten's value in the 50s and 60s, any country that had any kind of, you know, freedom, as it were, was mined. And other countries that had obviously much less freedom protected those resources because they understood how strategically important they were.
Do you think the challenge, you talked a minute about, you know, we already know about the shortage of semiconductors, potential shortage of tungsten. As you understand the market, you know, we potentially have this great change in demand, correct? That is going to require supply chains to react, infrastructure to react. Are there other either materials or metals that are going to go into the production of EVs that are going to be strained by this change in demand over the next, you know, 10 to 15 years?
Sure, all of them. All the metals are, from cobalt to lithium to tin to nickel to copper. I mean, there's a reason why. If you go back 12 years, copper was trading at, I think, around $6,000 a ton. Right now, it's $44,000.
Okay.
This is because there is a fundamental shift in demand. There's always been, you know, I've been operating mines for a very long time. And as an operator, you get used to the sort of boom and bust cycles of commodity prices. You know, you get the good years and you get the bad years. And you kind of... You get very much adapted to that because supply demand is essentially in an equilibrium. It's a balance. You know, we look at tungsten growth, for instance, consumption grows by sort of inflation every year, has done for a generation, you know, 3% a year. That's it. And all commodities are very similar in that, you know, when demand drops by 5%, prices go down. When demand goes up by 5%, prices go up. And that was always the cycle. What we're seeing now is entirely new sectors sitting alongside existing sectors putting demands that are far in excess of what's been previously experienced.
So to address it, you know, there are two things. One is build more battery factories. We're seeing in the news now where, you know, GM is committing, for instance, significant funds to build a battery factory in Michigan. You know, I know that Tesla has been building its own battery factories. So the question I'm sure that most people say is, well, why can't we just build more battery factories, or why can't we just mine more tungsten? What's the, you may not want to address the battery factory issue. That might, you know, be a different issue, but why can't we just mine more tungsten?
Well, I think I'll answer both, actually. The batteries, well, you can't just produce more batteries because you still need the components to build them. I mean, you know, it's like... They say you can't bake the bread without the oven and the flour. Right. And you know, so ultimately you can build as many bakeries as you like, but right. If you can't actually put the raw materials in it, you can't assemble the bread.
Yes, right, right.
So, you know, so I think that's one issue. And in fact, right. Look, I mean, I think it's worth thinking here about the systems that we all love to live under. So, for instance, democracies are far from perfect, and they have pros and cons. And the pros are fantastic, but there are some cons. And one of them being, you can't just do whatever you want when you feel like it. Everybody has a say. The reason why you can't just create more tungsten in mines in safe jurisdictions is because there's a process you have to go through in order to be able to mine there. And mining isn't exactly the most, I don't know, to put it. In many ways, people have a jaded view of mining. Whether that's right or wrong is for debate. I personally think the new mines that are coming online now are built to such a standard environmentally that there's absolutely no concerns with them. But the permitting process, the design permitting, it takes years.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it doesn't play to the base of, say, for instance, the current Biden administration. Their base is not saying build more mines. In fact, they're saying the opposite. We don't want them. So you then try and export that idea of having more access to raw materials to your allies, who also don't want them. You know, they all want them, but they don't want them in their backyard. And whereas when you go to a different political system, say, for instance, we see in China, if the state says we need more mines, then there is more mines. It's not open for a debate. You don't take public consultation with communities. None of that exists. Anyone living on the site is moved, and you build a mine. So it gives you much greater, you're much more nimble to address your supply chain. So we just have to find a way in which to essentially go through this process of evolving a supply chain, but understanding we're not going to be able to do it quickly because we should not loosen the regulations. We have to listen to communities. We have to consult with them. We have to keep these impacts. Otherwise, we just end up losing, part of the part of the pros of being in a democracy. And as an operator, sure, I'd love to go to bypass everything to get things done quickly. But at the same time, it exists for a reason, and people should have a voice, whether they should be built or not.
One of the mantras you used when we spoke for the first time was that I'm going to use in this case she for the XI, who controls the supply chain will win. So tell us about the role that China currently plays in the tungsten market and how you see its role the challenge for us because of China going forward.
Well, I mean, China's evolved their supply chain over 30 years. This wasn't done they didn't think about this last week. This has been a 30-year program, and they've executed absolutely fantastically. I mean, they are essentially probably the only manufacturing country in the world that almost has an entirely vertical supply chain. And that gives them a unique advantage in order to respond to demand that... Ultimately, if you have to compete with that, if you're more of a downstream producer, you need those raw materials, you often are dependent on a country such as China for that raw material, and you're competing with them producing the same product. And the days of saying that China does not have good quality are way behind us. Mm-hmm. China produces, within tungsten, for instance, a very good product now. This is no longer the times of, it's always Chinese going to fall to pieces. That's long gone. These guys really are on the top of their game. So, you have to, I think, look at, firstly, yes, I stand by that. Whoever has a access to raw materials is going to win this, say, for instance, this EV business. That's without any doubt. But I think you can't look at this as a Chinese-centric approach. You can't be saying, it's us and them. But you have to look at giving manufacturers in the United States the opportunity to have choice of their supply. That diversity has to exist because right now it doesn't. In order for them to be competitive, they must be able to have choice. And that ultimately is what politics has to really address. Are we doing enough to be able to enable our manufacturing bases to have access to a choice? We can buy from China, that's okay. But if you don't want to buy from China, where else can you go? So you don't have that choice.
So my last, you may have just addressed the last question, but I'll throw it out there anyway, just in case there's anything you want to add, which is 2035 doesn't seem so far away. You know, if we're sitting here at 2022, is there a way out of this? You know, you've spoken about the role government can play, and it feels like government and manufacturers are going to have to come, and communities are going to have to come together here. If on the one hand people say we want EVs, on the other hand, what's the price we're going to pay to get there? You know, how do you see us working through that? If you could, buy fiat to make it happen.
Well, I think ultimately at a political level, if we can just stay focused for long enough, because I think there was some great focus from the Biden administration when they first came in regarding the supply chain. And then, of course, everything else started to happen and sort of lost a bit of focus on it.
Yes.
But I think that realistically, countries are coming to the conclusion that inevitably they are going to have to encourage local supply of certain key strategic raw materials. There's no way around it. It takes a little bit longer for politics to really get their head around that, because, you know, not everyone is going to be happy with that decision. But the alternative is, and the pressure won't come so much from the voting population, well, of course they vote, but from industry itself. The GMs, the Fords, will insist that a program come into place because they keep losing market share to competitors. You know, ultimately, this is all about market share. And whoever has access now, like Tesla, is going to keep increasing their market share. Once you have that market share, once you've gone Tesla, do you really then go to a Volkswagen, for instance? You know, brand loyalty, especially in these new technologies, is very strong. It's like you have an iPhone, you don't necessarily want to go to an Android the next day.
Yes.
So they understand with this technology, with these technologies, that there's a great loyalty to it. So the ultimately what's going to happen now is that industry itself has to put the pressure on government to say, look, you got to help us. I mean, it doesn't really help when the Biden administration had a meeting with, I think, GM and Ford about electric EVs and didn't invite Tesla, and Tesla's selling a million units a year. I mean, it's just, and there was talk that subsidies from the federal government would only be applied to unionized car manufacturers. I mean, you know, people want these vehicles. They want right. them to have a range. They want them to have the price that is affordable. And they want them now. So now governments have to stop sort of making sound bites and say, okay, here is our clear strategy to be able to provide the raw materials, or give the facilities for the raw materials to actually be available, so that American manufacturers can really claim market share and compete here.
Lewis, thanks so much. And, you know, my big takeaway from what you just said, and I think this conversation overall, is just like supply chain is so much in the news now, you know, we used to take it for granted, or the consumer did, that this is going to be a supply chain issue. It's going to be there's going to be the demand, and how we satisfy that demand is going to be the bottleneck that we have to work out. So
absolutely.
Again. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That's all the time we have today. I want to give another special thanks to Lewis Black for joining me, and thank you for listening. I hope you'll be back for our next episode for Supply Chain Management Review. I'm Bob Troublecock, and Lewis, again, thanks so much. This was a great conversation.
Thanks, Bob. Have a great day. Thank you.
Yep. You too. Talking Supply Chain is produced by Supply Chain Management Review and Peerless Media. You can find it on scmr.com, on iTunes, or under SC247, or just Google SC247 podcasts. For more information, be sure to visit scmr.com. We hope you'll join us again.